With a grim smile of purest hatred for me, he turned aside and rejoined the group around Regal, who was speaking with King Eod. For whatever reason, I had the complete attention of Rurisk and Ketriken. I did not know my father well, but I think he would be pleased to see. I began, but at that moment, Princess Ketriken smiled brilliantly at me.
Of course! How could I have been so stupid? You are the one they call Fitz. Do you not usually travel with Lady Time, King Shrewd's poisoner? And are you not training as her apprentice? Regal has spoken of you.
How kind of him, I said inanely, and I have no idea what next was said to me, nor what I replied. I could only be thankful I did not reel where I stood. And inside me, for the first time, I acknowledged that what I felt for Regal went beyond distaste. Rurisk frowned a brother's rebuke at Ketriken, and then turned to deal with a servant urgently asking his instructions about something. Around me, people conversed genially amid summer colors and scents, but I felt as if my guts had turned to ice. I came back to myself when Ketriken plucked at my sleeve.
They are this way, she informed me. Or are you too weary to enjoy them now? If you wish to retire, it will offend no one. I understand that many of you were too weary to even walk into the city.
But many of us were not, and would truly have enjoyed the chance to walk leisurely through Jompe. I have been told of the blue fountains, and look forward to seeing them. I only faltered slightly as I said this, and hoped it had some bearing on what she had been saying to me. At least, it had nothing to do with poison.
I will be sure you are guided to them, perhaps this evening, but for now, come this way.
And with no more ado or formality than that, she led me away from the gathering. August watched after us as we walked away, and I saw Regal turn and say something in an aside to Raud. King Eod had withdrawn from the crowd and was looking benignly down on all from an elevated platform. I wondered why Raud had not remained with the horses and other servants. But then Ketriken was drawing a painted screen aside from a door opening, and we were leaving the main room of the palace. We were outside, in fact, walking on a stone pathway under an archway of trees. They were willows, and their living branches had been interlaced and woven overhead to form a green screen from the noon sun.
And they shed rain from the path, too. At least most of it.
Ketriken added as she noted my interest.
This path leads to the shade gardens. They are my favorites. But perhaps you would wish to see the herbary first.
I shall enjoy seeing any and all of the gardens, my lady, I replied, and this at least was true. Out here, away from the crowd, I would have more chance to sort my thoughts and ponder what to do in my untenable position. It was occurring to me, belatedly, that Prince Rurisk had shown none of the signs of injury or illness that Regal had reported. I needed to withdraw from the situation and reevaluate it. There was more. Much more going on than I had been prepared for. But with an effort, I pulled my thoughts away from my own dilemma and focused on what the princess was telling me. She spoke her words clearly, and I found her conversation much easier to follow away from the background chatter of the great hall. She seemed to know much about the gardens, and gave me to understand that it was not a hobby, but knowledge that was expected of her as a princess. As we walked and talked, I constantly had to remind myself that she was a princess and betrothed to Verity. I had never encountered a woman like her before. She wore a quiet dignity, quite unlike the awareness of station that I usually encountered in those better born than I. But she did not hesitate to smile, or become enthused, or stoop to dig in the soil around a plant, to show me a particular type of root she was describing. She rubbed the root free of dirt, then sliced a bit with her belt knife from the heart of the tuber to allow me to taste its tang. She showed me certain pungent herbs for seasoning meat, and insisted I taste a leaf of each of three varieties, for though the plants were very similar, the flowers were very different. In a way, she was like Patience, without her eccentricity. In another way, she was like Molly, but without the callousness that Molly had been forced to develop to survive. Like Molly, she spoke directly and frankly to me, as if we were equals. I found myself thinking that Verity might find this woman more to his liking than he expected. And yet, another part of me worried what Verity would think of his bride. He was not a womanizer, but his taste in women was obvious to anyone who had been much around him. And those that he smiled upon were usually small and round and dark, often with curly hair and girlish laughter and tiny soft hands. What would he think of this tall, pale woman, who dressed as simply as a servant, and declared she took much pleasure in tending her own gardens? As our talk turned, I found she could speak as familiarly about falconry and horse-breeding as any stableman. And when I asked her what she did for pleasure, she told me of her small forge and tools for working metal, and lifted her hair to show me the earrings she had made for herself. The finely hammered silver petals of a flower clasped a tiny gem, like a drop of dew. I had once told Molly that Verity deserved a competent and active wife, but now I wondered if she would much beguile him. He would respect her, I knew, but was respect enough between a king and his queen? I resolved not to borrow trouble, but to keep my word to Verity instead. I asked her if Regal had told her much of her husband, and she became suddenly quiet. I sensed her drawing on her strength, as she replied that she knew he was a king-in-waiting, with many problems facing his realm. Regal had warned her that Verity was much older than she was, a plain and simple man, who might not take much interest in her. Regal had promised to be ever by her, helping her to adapt, and doing his best to see that the court was not a lonely place for her, so she was prepared. "How old are you?" I asked impulsively.
18,
she replied, and then smiled to see the surprise on my face.
"Because I am tall, your people seem to think I am much older than that,"
she confided in me.
"Well, you are younger than Verity, then. Not so much more than between many wives and husbands. He will be 33 this spring." "I had thought him much older than that," she said wonderingly. "Regal explained they share but a father. It is true that Chivalry and Verity were both sons of King Shrewd's first queen, but there is not that great a span between them, and Verity, when he is not burdened with the problems of state, is not so dour and severe as you might imagine him. He is a man who knows how to laugh." She cast me a sideways glance, as if to see if I was trying to put a better face on Verity than he deserved. "It is true, Princess. I have seen him laugh like a child at the puppet shows at Spring Fest, and when all join in for luck at the fruit press to make fall wine, he does not hold back. But his greatest pleasure has always been the hunt. He has a wolfhound, Leon, whom he holds dearer than some men hold their sons."
"But—"
Ketriken ventured to interrupt.
"Surely this is as he was once, for Regal speaks of him as a man older than his years, bent down by the cares of his people."
"Bent down as a tree burdened by snow that springs erect again with the coming of spring. His last words to me before I left, Princess, were to desire me to speak well of him to you." She cast her eyes down quickly, as if to hide from me the sudden lift of her heart.
"I see a different man when you speak of him."
She paused, and then closed her mouth firmly, forbidding herself the request I heard anyway. "I have always seen him as a kind man, as kind as one lifted to such a responsibility can be. He takes his duties very seriously, and will not spare himself from what his folk need of him. This it is that has made him unable to come here to you. He engages in a battle with the Red Ship Raiders, one he couldn't fight from here. He gives up his interests of a man to fulfill his duty as a prince, not through a coldness of spirit or a lack of life in himself. She gave me a sideways glance, fighting the smile from her face, as if what I told her were the sweetest flattery such as a princess must not believe. He is taller than I am, but only by a bit. His hair is very dark, as is his beard when he lets it grow. His eyes are blacker still, yet when he is enthused, they shine. It is true there is a scattering of grey in his hair now that you would not have found a year ago. True also that his work has kept him from the sun and the wind, so his shoulders no longer tear the seams of his shirts. But my uncle is still very much a man, and I believe that when the danger of the red ships has been driven from our shores, he will ride and shout and hunt with his hound once more. "You give me heart," she muttered, and then straightened herself, as if she had admitted some weakness. Looking at me gravely, she asked, "Why does Regal not speak of his brother so? I thought I went to an old man, shaking of hand, too burdened by his duties to see a wife as anything other than a duty. Perhaps he—" I began, and could think of no courtier's way to say that Regal was frequently deceptive if it gained him his goal. For the life of me, I had no idea what goal might be served by making Ketrickan so dread Verity. "Perhaps he has been unflattering about other things as well," Ketrickan suddenly supposed aloud. Something seemed to alarm her. She took a breath and became suddenly franker. "There was an evening in my chamber, when we had dined, and Regal had, perhaps, drunk a bit too well. He told tales of you then, saying you had once been a sullen, spoiled child, too ambitious for your birth, but that since the king had made you his prisoner, you seemed content with your lot. He said it seemed to suit you, for even as a boy you had enjoyed eavesdropping and skulking about and other secretive pursuits. Now, I do not tell you this to make a mischief, but only to let you know what I first believed of you. The next day, Regal begged me to believe it had been the fancies of the wine rather than the facts he had shared with me. But one thing he had said that night was too icy a fear for me to entirely lay aside. He said that if the king did send you or Lady Time, it would be to poison my brother, so that I might be the sole heir to the Mountain Kingdom. You are speaking too quickly, I chided her gently, and hoped my smile did not look as dizzy and sickly as I suddenly felt. I did not understand all you said. Desperately, I strove to think of what to say. Even as accomplished a liar as I, found such a direct confrontation uncomfortable. I am sorry, but you speak our language so well, almost like a native, almost as if you were recalling it rather than learning it new. I will go more slowly. Some weeks, no, it was over a month ago, Regal came to my chambers. He had asked if he might dine alone with me, that we might get to know one another better, and—
Ketrickan! It was Rurisk, calling down the path as he came seeking us. Regal is asking that you would come and meet the lords and ladies who have come so far to see your marriage.
Chong Kui was at his shoulder, hurrying after him, and as the second and unmistakable wave of dizziness hit me, I thought she looked too knowing. And I asked myself, what step would Chade have taken if someone had sent a poisoner to Shrewd's court to eliminate Verity?
All too obvious.
Perhaps, Jonqui suddenly suggested, Fitz Chivalry would like to be shown the blue fountains now. Litress has said she would gladly take him. Maybe this afternoon, I managed to say. I find myself suddenly wearied. I think I shall seek my chamber. None of them looked surprised. "Shall I have some wine sent to you?" Jonqui asked graciously. "Or perhaps some soup?"
The others will be summoned to a meal soon, but if you are tired, it is no trouble to bring food to you. Years of training came to the fore. I kept my posture straight, despite the sudden fire in my belly. "That would be most kind of you," I managed to say. The brief bow I forced myself to make was sophisticated torture. "I am sure I will rejoin you soon." And I excused myself, and I did not run, nor curl in a ball and whimper as I wished to. I walked, with obvious enjoyment of the plantings, back through the garden to the door of the great hall. And all three of them watched me go, and spoke softly together of what we all knew. I had but one trick left to me, and small hope it would be effective. Back in my room I dug out the sea purge the fool had given me. How long, I wondered, had it been since I had eaten the honey cakes? For that was the venue I would have chosen. Fatalistically I decided I would trust the ewer of water in my room. A tiny part of me said that was foolish, but as wave after wave of giddiness washed over me, I felt incapable of any further thought. With shaking hands I crumbled the sea purge into water. The dried herb absorbed the water and became a green, sticky wad, which I managed to choke down. I knew it would empty my stomach and bowels. The only question was, would it be swift enough? Or was the Chiurda poison too widespread in me? I spent a miserable evening that I will not dwell on. No one came to my room with soup or wine. In my moments of lucidity, I decided they would not come until they were sure their poison had had its effect. Morning, I decided. They would send a servant to waken me, and he would discover my death. I had until morning. It was past midnight when I was able to stand. I left my room as silently as my shaking legs would carry me, and went out into the garden. I found a cistern of water there, and drank until I thought I would burst. I ventured farther into the garden, walking slowly and carefully, for I ached as if I had been beaten and my head pounded painfully with each step I took. But eventually, I stumbled into an area of fruit trees so gracefully trained along a wall, and as I had hoped, they were heavy with the harvest. I helped myself, filling my jerkin with a supply. These I would conceal in my room to give me food I could safely consume. Sometime tomorrow I would make an excuse to go down and check on Sooty. My saddlebags still held some dried meat and hard bread. I hoped it would be enough to get me through this visit. And as I made my way back to my room, I wondered what else they would try when they found the poison hadn't worked. 21. Princes of the Chiurdan herb carry me. Their saying is, a leaf to sleep, two to dull pain, three for a merciful grave. Toward dawn I finally dozed, only to be awakened by Prince Rurisk flinging aside the screen that served as door to my chamber. He burst into the room, flourishing a sloshing decanter. The looseness of the garment that fluttered about him declared it a night-robe. I rolled quickly from the bed and managed to stand, with the bedstead between us. I was cornered, sick and weaponless, save for my belt-knife.
"You still live?"
he exclaimed in amazement, then advanced on me with his flask.
"Quick, drink this."
"I would sooner not," I told him, retreating as he advanced. Seeing my wariness, he paused.
"You have taken poison," he told me carefully. "It is fully a miracle of Chiranzuli that you still live. This is a purge that will flush it from your body. Take it, and you may still live."
"There is nothing left in my body to purge," I told him bluntly, and then caught at a table as I began to shake. "I knew I had been poisoned when I left you last night."
"And you said nothing to me?"
He was incredulous. He turned back to the door where Ketriken now peeked in timidly. Her hair was in tousled braids, and her eyes red with weeping.
"It is averted, small thanks to you."
her brother told her severely. Go and make him a salty broth from some of last night's meat, and bring a sweet pastry as well. Enough for both of us, and tea. Go now, you foolish girl.
Ketriken scampered off like a child. Rurisk gestured at the bed.
Come. Trust me enough to sit down. Before you upset the table with your shaking, I am speaking plainly to you. You and I, Fitzchivalry, we have no time for this distrust. There is much we must speak of, you and I.
I sat down, not out of trust so much as for fear I would otherwise collapse. Without formality, Rurisk sat down on the end of the bed.
My sister, he said gravely, is impetuous. Poor Verity will find her more child than woman, I fear. And much of that is my fault. I have spoiled her so. But although that explains her fondness for me, it does not excuse her poisoning of a guest, especially not on the eve of her wedding to his uncle.
I think I would have felt much the same about it at any time, I said, and Rurisk threw back his head and laughed.
There is much of your father in you. So would he have said, I'm sure. But I must explain. She came to me days ago to tell me that you were coming to make an end of me. I told her then that it was not her concern and I would take care of it, but, as I have said, she is impulsive. Yesterday she saw an opportunity and took it, with no regard as to how the death of a guest might affect a carefully negotiated wedding. She thought only to do away with you before vows bound her to the six duchies, and made such an act unthinkable. I should have suspected it when she took you so quickly to the gardens.
The herbs she gave me?
He nodded, and I felt a fool. But after you had eaten them, you spoke so fair to her that she came to doubt you could be what it was said you were. So, she asked you. But you turned the question aside by pretending to not understand. So again she doubted you. Still, it should not have taken her all night to come to me with her tale of what she had done and her doubts of the wisdom of it. For that, I apologize.
Too late to apologize. I have already forgiven you, I heard myself say.
Rurisk looked at me. That was your father's saying as well.
He glanced at the door a moment before Ketriken came through it. Once she was within the room, he slid the screen shut and took the tray from her.
Sit down, he told her sternly, and see another way of dealing with an assassin.
He lifted a heavy mug from the tray and drank deeply of it, before passing it to me. He shot Ketriken another glance.
And if that was poisoned, you have just killed your brother as well.
He broke an apple pastry into three portions.
Select one, he told me.
And then he took that one for himself, and gave the next I chose to Ketriken.
So you may see there is nothing amiss with this food.
I see small reason why you should give me poisoning this morning after coming to tell me I was poisoned last night, I admitted. Still, my palate was alive, questing for the slightest mistake. But there was none. It was rich, flaky pastry, stuffed with ripe apples and spices. Even if I had not been so empty, it would have been delicious.
Exactly, Rurisk said in a sticky voice, and then swallowed. And if you were an assassin,
here he shot a warning to silence Ketriken.
You would find yourself in the same position. Some murders are only profitable if no one else knows they were murders. Such would be my death. Were you to slay me now, indeed, were I to die within the next 6 months, Ketriken and Jonqui both would be shrieking to the stars that I had been assassinated. Scarcely a good foundation for an alliance of peoples, do you agree?
I managed a nod. The warm broth in the mug had stilled most of my trembling, and the sweet pastry tasted fit for a god.
So, we agree that were you an assassin, there would now be no profit to carrying out my murder. Indeed, there would be a very great loss to you if I died. For my father does not look on this alliance with the favor that I do, Oh, he knows it is wise, for now. But I see it as more than wise. I see it as necessary. Tell this to King Shrood. Our population grows, but there is a limit to our arable soil. Wild game will only feed so many. Comes a time when a country must open itself to trade, especially so rocky and mountainous a country as mine. You have heard, perhaps, that the Jampe way is that the ruler is the servant of his people? Well, I serve them in this wise. I marry my beloved younger sister away in the hopes of winning grain and trade routes and lowland goods for my people, and grazing rights in the cold part of the year when our pastures are under snow. For this, too, I am willing to give you timbers, the great straight timbers that Verity will need to build his warships. Our mountains grow white oak, such as you have never seen. This is a thing my father would refuse. He has the old feelings about the cutting of live trees, and, like Regal, he sees your coast as a liability, your ocean as a great barrier. But I see it as your father did. A wide road that leads in all directions, and your coast as our access to it. And I see no offense in using trees uprooted by the annual floods and windstorms. I held my breath a moment. This was a momentous decision. I found myself nodding to his words. So, will you carry my words to King Shrood, and say to him that it is better to have a live friend in me? I could think of no reason not to agree. Aren't you going to ask him if he intended to poison you? Ketrickin demanded. If he answered yes, you would never trust him. If he answered no, you would probably not believe him and think him a liar as well as an assassin. Besides, is not one admitted poisoner in this room enough? Ketrickin ducked her head, and a flush suffused her cheeks. So come, Rorisk told her, and held out a conciliatory hand. Our guest must get what little rest he can before the day's festivities, and we must be back to our chambers before the whole household wonders why we are dashing about in our night clothes. And they left me, to lie back on my bed and wonder, what manner of folk were these that I dealt with? Could I believe their open honesty, or was it a magnificent sham, for Ida knew what ends? I wished Chade were here. More and more I felt nothing was as it seemed. I dared not doze, for I knew if I fell asleep, nothing would wake me before nightfall. Servants came soon with pitchers of warm water and cool, and fruit and cheese on a platter. Reminding myself that these servants might be better born than myself, I treated them all with great courtesy, and later wondered if that might not be the secret of their harmonious household, that all the servants, or royalty, be treated with the same courtesy. It was a day of great festivity. The entries to the palace had been thrown wide open, and folk had come from every vale and dell of the mountain kingdom to witness this pledging. Poets and minstrels performed, and more gifts were exchanged, including my formal presentation of the herbals and herbstarts. The breeding stock that had been sent from the six duchies was displayed and then gifted forth again to those most in need of it, or most likely to be successful with it. A single ram or bull, with a female or two, might be sent out as a common gift to the whole village. All of the gifts, whether fowl or beast, or grain or metal, were brought within the palace so that all might admire them. Burich was there. For the first time I had glimpsed him in days. He might have been up before dawn to have his charges so glossy. Every hoof was freshly oiled, every mane and tail plaited with bright ribbons and bells. The mare to be given to Ketrickin was saddled and bridled in harness of finest leather, and her mane and tail hung with so many tiny silver bells that each swish of her tail was a chorus of tinkling. Our horses were different creatures from the small and shaggy stock of the mountain folk, and attracted quite a crowd. Burich looked weary, yet proud, and his horses stood calmly amidst the clamour. Ketrickin spent a deal of time admiring her mare, and I saw her courtesy and deference thawing Burich's reserve. When I drew closer, I was surprised to hear him speaking in hesitant but clear Chiorda.
But a greater surprise was in store for me that afternoon. Food had been set out on long tables, and all palace residents and visitors dined freely. Much had come from the kitchens of the palace, but much more from the mountain folk themselves. They came forward without hesitation to set out wheels of cheese and loaves of dark bread and dried or smoked meats, or pickles, or bowls of fruit. It would have been tempting had not my stomach still been so touchy. But the way the food was given was what impressed me. It was unquestioning, this giving and taking between the royalty and their subjects. I noted, too, there were no sentries or guards of any kind upon the doors, and all mingled and talked as they ate. At noon, precisely, a silence fell over the crowd. The Princess Ketriken, alone, ascended the central dais. In simple language, she announced to all that she now belonged to the six duchies, and hoped to serve that land well. She thanked her land for all it had ever done for her, for the food it had grown to feed her, the waters of its snows and rivers, the airs of the mountain breezes. She reminded all that she did not change her allegiance due to any lack of love for her land, but rather in the hopes of it benefiting both the lands. All kept silent as she spoke, and as she descended from the dais. And then the merriment resumed. Rurisk came seeking me out to see how I did. I did my best to assure him I was fully recovered, though in truth I longed to be sleeping. The clothing Mistress Hasty had decreed for me was of the latest court fashion and featured highly inconvenient sleeves and tassels that fell into anything I tried to do or eat, and an uncomfortably snug waist. I longed to be out of the press of people, where I could loosen some laces and get rid of the collar. But I knew that if I left now, Chade would frown when I reported to him, and demand that I somehow know all that had happened while I was absent. Rurisk, I think, sensed my need for a bit of quiet, for he suddenly proposed a stroll out to his kennels. "Let me show you what the addition of some six duchies' blood a few years back did for my dogs," he offered. We left the palace and walked down a short way to a long, low wooden building. The clean air cleared my head and lifted my spirits. Inside, he showed me a pen where a bitch presided over a litter of red pups. They were healthy little creatures, glossy of coat, nipping and tumbling about in the straw. They came readily, totally unafraid of us. "These are of Buckkeep lineage, and will hold to a scent even in a downpour," he told me proudly. He showed me other breeds as well, including a tiny dog with wiry legs, which, he claimed, would clamber right up a tree after game. We emerged from his kennels and out into the sun, where an older dog slept lazily on a pile of straw. "Sleep on, old man. You've fathered enough pups that you never need hunt again, except you love it so," Rurisk told him genially. At the master's voice, the old hound heaved himself to his feet and came to lean affectionately on Rurisk. He looked up at me, and it was Nosy. I stared at him, and his copper-ore eyes returned the look. I quested softly toward him, and for a moment received only puzzlement, and then a flood of warmth, of affection shared and remembered. There was no doubt that he was Rurisk's hound now. The intensity of the bond that had been between us was gone. But he offered me back great fondness and warm memories of when we were puppies together. I went down on one knee and stroked the red coat gone all bristly with the years, and looked into the eyes that were beginning to show the clouding of age. For an instant, with the physical touch, the bond was as it had been. I knew he was enjoying dozing in the sun, but could be persuaded to go hunt with very little trouble, especially if Rurisk came along. I patted his back and drew away from him. I looked up to find Rurisk regarding me strangely. "I knew him when he was just a puppy," I told him. "Burich sent him to me, in care of a wandering scribe, these many years ago," Rurisk told me. "He has brought me great pleasure. In company,
and in hunting. You have done well by him, I said. We left and strolled back to the palace, but as soon as Rurisk left my side, I went straight to Burridge. As I came up, he had just received permission to take the horses outside and into the open air, for even the calmest beast will grow restive in close quarters with many strangers. I could see his dilemma. While he was taking horses out, he would be leaving the others untended. He looked up warily as I approached. With your leave, I will help you move them, I offered. Burridge's face remained impassive and polite. But before he could open his mouth to speak, a voice behind me said, I am here to do that, master. You might soil your sleeves, or overly weary yourself working with beasts. I turned slowly, baffled by the venom in Cobb's voice. I glanced from him to Burridge, but Burridge did not speak. I looked squarely at Burridge. Then I will walk alongside you, if I may, for I have something important we must speak of. My words were deliberately formal. For a moment longer, Burridge gazed at me. Bring the princess's mare, he said at last, and that bay filly. I will take the greys. Cobb, mind the rest for me, I shan't be long. And so I took the mare's head and the filly's lead rope and followed Burridge as he edged the horses through the crowd and out of doors. There is a paddock this way, he said, and no more. We walked for a bit in silence. The crowd thinned rapidly once we were away from the palace. The horses' hooves thudded pleasantly against the earth. We came to the paddock, which fronted on a small barn with a tack room. For a moment or two it almost seemed normal to be working alongside Burridge again. I unsaddled the mare and wiped the nervous sweat from her, while he shook out grain into a grain box for them. He came to stand beside me as I finished with the mare. She's a beauty, I said admiringly. From Lord Ranger's stock?
Yes.
His word cut off the conversation.
You wish to speak to me?
I took a great breath, then said it simply. I just saw Nosey. He's fine. Older now, but he's had a happy life. All these years, Burridge, I always believed you killed him that night. Dashed out his brains, cut his throat, strangled him. I imagined it a dozen different ways, a thousand times. All those years. He looked at me incredulously.
You believed I would kill a dog for something you did?
I only knew he was gone. I could imagine nothing else. I thought it was my punishment. For a long time he was still. When he looked back up at me, I could see his torment.
How you must have hated me.
And feared you.
All those years? And you never learned better of me, never thought to yourself he would not do such a thing?
I shook my head slowly.
Oh, Fitz,
he said sadly. One of the horses came to nudge at him, and he patted it absently.
I thought you were stubborn and sullen. You thought you had been grievously wronged. No wonder we have been so much at odds.
It can be undone, I offered quietly.
I have missed you, you know.
Missed you sorely, despite all our differences. I watched him thinking, and for a moment or two I thought he would smile and clap me on the shoulder and tell me to go fetch the other horses. But his face grew still, and then stern.
But for all that, it did not stop you. You believed I had it in me to kill any animal you used the wit on, but it did not stop you from doing it.
I don't see it the way you do, I began, but he shook his head.
We are better parted, boy. Better for both of us. There can be no misunderstandings if there are no understandings at all. I can never approve or ignore what you do. Never.
Come to me when you can say you will do it no more. I will take your word on it, for you've never broken your word to me. But until then, we are better parted.
He left me standing by the paddock, and went back for his other horses. I stood a long time feeling sick and weary, and not just from Ketrickin's poison. But I went back into the palace and walked about and spoke to people and ate, and even endured with silence the mocking, triumphant smiles Cobb gave me. The day seemed longer than any 2 days in my previous experience. Had not it been for my burning and gurgling stomach, I would have found it exciting and absorbing. The afternoon and early evening were given over to congenial contests of archery, wrestling, and foot races. Young and old, male and female, joined in on these contests, and there seemed to be some mountain tradition that whoever won such contests on such an auspicious occasion would enjoy luck for a full turn of a year. Then there was more food, and singing, and dancing of dancers, and an entertainment like a puppet show, but done all with shadows on a screen of silk. By the time folk began to retire, I was more than ready for my bed. It was a relief to close my chamber screen and be alone. I was just peeling off my annoying shirt and reflecting on what a strange day it had been, when there was a tap at my door. Before I could speak, Severins slid open the screen and slipped in. "Regal commands your presence," he told me.
"Now?"
I asked, owlishly. "Why else would he send me now?" Severins demanded. Wearily, I pulled my shirt back on and followed him out of the room. Regal's chambers were in an upper level of the palace. It was not really a second floor, but more like a wooden terrace built to one side of the great hall. The walls were screens, and there was a sort of balcony where he might stand and look down before descending. These rooms were much more richly decorated. Some of the work was obviously Tiurda, bright birds brushed onto silk panels and figurines carved of amber. But much of the tapestries and statues and hangings looked to me like things Regal had acquired for his own pleasure and comfort. I stood waiting in his antechamber while he finished his bath. By the time he ambled out in his nightshirt, it was all I could do to keep my eyes open.
"Well?" he demanded of me.
I looked at him blankly. "You summoned me," I reminded him.
"Yes, I did. I should like to know why it was necessary. I thought you had received some sort of training in this sort of thing. How long were you going to wait before you reported to me?"
I could think of nothing to say. I had never remotely considered reporting to Regal, to Shrewd or Chade, definitely, and to Verity, but to Regal?
"Need I remind you of your duty? Report!"
I hastily gathered my wits. "Would you hear my observations on the Tiurda as a people, or information on the herbs they grow, or—"
"I want to know what you are doing about your assignment. Have you acted yet? Have you made a plan? When can we expect results, and of what kind? I scarcely want the prince dropping dead at my feet, and me unprepared for it."
I could scarcely credit what I was hearing. Never had Shrewd spoken so bluntly or so openly of my work, and even when our privacy was assured, he circled and danced and left me to draw my own conclusions. I had seen Severins go into his other chamber, but had no idea where the man was now or how sound carried in this chamber. And Regal was speaking as if we were discussing shoeing a horse.
"Are you being insolent or stupid?"
Regal demanded. "Neither," I rejoined as politely as I was able. "I am being cautious, my prince." I added this last in the hopes of putting the conversation on a more formal level.
"You are being foolishly cautious. I trust my valet, and there is no one else here, so report, my bastard assassin."
He said the last words as if he thought them cleverly sarcastic. I took a breath and reminded myself that I was a king's man, and in this time and place, this was as close to a king as I was going to get. I chose my phrases carefully. Yesterday in the garden, Princess Ketrigan told me you had told her I was a poisoner, and that her brother, Rurisk, was my target.
A lie, Regal said decisively. I told her nothing of the kind. Either you had clumsily betrayed yourself, or she was merely fishing for information. I hope you have not spoiled all by revealing yourself to her.
I could have lied much better than he did. I let his remarks slide by and went on. I gave him a full report of my poisoning and of Rurisk and Ketrigan's early morning visit. I repeated our conversation verbatim, and when I was finished, Regal spent a number of minutes looking at his nails before he spoke to me.
And have you decided on a method and time yet?
I tried not to show my surprise. Under the circumstances, I thought it better to abandon the assignment.
No nerve,
Regal observed with disgust.
I asked Father to send that old whore, Lady Time. She'd have had him in his grave by now.
Sir? I asked questioningly. That he referred to Chade as Lady Time made me nearly certain that he knew nothing at all. He suspected, of course, but making revelations about Chade was definitely outside my realm.
Sir,
Regal mimicked back at me, and for the first time I realized the man was drunk. Physically, he carried it well. He did not stink of it, but it brought all his pettiness to the surface. He sighed heavily, as if too disgusted for words, then flung himself down on a couch draped with blankets and cushions.
Nothing has changed, he informed me. You've been given your task. Do it. If you are clever, you can make it appear an accident. Having been so naively open with Ketrigan and Rurisk, neither will expect it, but I want it done. Before tomorrow evening.
Before the wedding? I asked incredulously. Don't you think the death of the bride's brother might lead her to cancel it?
It would be no more than temporary if she did. I have her well in hand, boy. She is easily dazzled. That end of this thing is my concern. Yours is getting rid of her brother. Now. How will you do it?
I've no idea. That seemed a better answer than saying I had no intention. I would return to Buckkeep and report back to Shrewd and Chade. If they said I had chosen wrongly, then they might do with me as they wished. But I remembered Regal's own voice from so long ago, quoting Shrewd, "Don't do what you can't undo until you've considered what you can't do once you've done it."
When will you know?
He demanded sarcastically. I don't know. I hedged. These things cannot be done recklessly or sloppily. I need to study the man and his habits, explore his chambers, and learn the habits of his servants. I must find a way to—
The wedding is 2 days hence,
Regal interrupted. The focus of his eyes softened.
I already know all the things you say you must discover. Easiest then for me is to plan it for you. Come to me tomorrow night, and I will give you your orders. Mind this well, bastard. I do not want you to act before you have informed me. I would find any surprise unpleasant. You would find it deadly.
He lifted his eyes to me, but I kept my face a careful blank.
You are dismissed,
he told me regally.
Report to me here tomorrow night at the same time. Do not make me send Severins to fetch you. He has more important tasks, and do not think my father will not hear of your laxity. He will. He will regret not sending bitch time to do this little deed.
He leaned back heavily and yawned, and I caught a whiff of wine and a subtle smoke. I wondered if he was learning his mother's habits. I returned to my chambers, intending to ponder carefully all my options and formulate a plan, but so weary was I, and half sick, that I was asleep as soon as my head touched the pillow. 22. Dilemmas.
In the dream, the fool stood by my bed.
He looked down at me and shook his head.
"Why cannot I speak clearly? Because you make it all a muddle. I see a crossroads through the fog, and who always stands within it? You! Do you think I keep you alive because I am so entranced with you? No. It is because you create so many possibilities. While you live, you give us more choices. The more choices, the more chances to steer for calmer water. So it is not for your benefit, but for the 6 duchies that I preserve your life, and your duty is the same. To live, so that you may continue to present possibilities."
I awoke in precisely the same quandary I had gone to sleep in. I had no idea of what I was going to do. I lay in my bed, listening to the random sounds of the palace awaking. I needed to talk to Chade. That was not possible. So I lightly closed my eyes and tried to think as he had taught me.
"What do you know?"
he would have asked me, and,
"What do you suspect?"
So, Regal had lied to King Shrewd about Rurisk's health and his attitude toward the 6 duchies. Or possibly, King Shrewd had lied to me about what Regal had said. Or Rurisk had lied about his inclinations toward us. I pondered a moment and decided to follow my first assumption. Shrewd had never lied to me, that I knew, and Rurisk could have simply let me die instead of rushing to my room. So, Regal wanted Rurisk dead. Or did he? If he wanted Rurisk dead, why did he betray me to Ketriken? Unless she had lied about that, I considered. Not likely. She might wonder if Shrewd would send an assassin, but why would she immediately decide to accuse me? No. She had recognized my name and known of Lady Time. So. And Regal had said twice last night that he had asked his father to send Lady Time, but he had likewise betrayed her name to Ketriken. Who did Regal really want dead? Prince Rurisk? Or Lady Time or me after an assassination attempt was discovered? And how did any of it benefit him and this marriage he had engineered? And why was he insisting I kill Rurisk when all the political advantages were to his living? I needed to talk to Chade. I couldn't. I had to somehow decide this myself. Unless. Servants again brought water and fruit. I arose and dressed in my annoying clothes, and ate, and left my chambers. This day was much the same as yesterday. The holiday atmosphere was beginning to wear on me. I attempted to employ my time to advantage, enlarging my knowledge of the palace, its routines and layout. I found Eod's, Ketriken's, and Rurisk's chambers. I also carefully studied the staircase and support structures to Regal's. I discovered that Cobb slept in the stables, as did Burridge. I expected that of Burridge he would not surrender the care of Buckkeep horses until he left Jampe. But why was Cobb sleeping there? To impress Burridge or to watch him? Severins and Raud both slept in the antechamber of Regal's apartments, despite a plentitude of rooms in the palace. I tried to study the distributions and schedules of the guards and sentries, but couldn't find any. And all the while, I watched for August. It took me the better part of the morning before I could find him in quiet circumstance. "I need to talk to you privately," I told him. He looked annoyed and glanced about to see if anyone were watching us. "Not here, Fitz. Maybe when we get back to Buckkeep. I've official duties and..." I had been prepared for that. I opened my hand to show him the pin the king had given me so many years ago. "Do you see this? I had it from King Shrewd a long time ago, and with it his promise that if I ever needed to speak to him, I need only show it, and I would be admitted to his chambers."
"How touching,"
August observed cynically. "And had you some reason for telling me this story, to impress me with your importance, perhaps?" "I need to speak to the king. Now."
"He isn't here,"
August pointed out. He turned to walk away. I took hold of his arm, turned him back to me. "You can skill to him." He shook me off angrily, and glanced about us again.
"I most certainly cannot, and would not if I could. Do you think every man who can skill is allowed to interrupt the king?"
"I have shown you the pin. I promise you he would not regard this as an interruption."
"I cannot."
"Verity, then."
"I do not skill to Verity until he skills to me first. Bastard, you don't understand. You took the training and you failed at it, and you really have not the slightest comprehension of what the skill is about. It is not like hallooing to a friend across a valley. It is a serious thing, not to be used except for serious purposes."
Again he turned away from me. "Turn back, August, or regret it long." I put every ounce of menace I could into my voice. It was an empty threat. I had no real way to make him regret it, other than threatening to tattle to the king. "Shrewd will not be pleased that you ignored his token." August turned slowly back. He glared at me.
"Well,
I will do this thing then, but you must promise to take all blame for it."
"I will."
"Will you come to my chambers then, and skill for me now? Is there no other place?"
"Your chambers?"
I suggested.
"No, that is even worse. Do not take it amiss, bastard, but I do not wish to seem to associate with you."
"Take it not amiss, lordling, that I feel the same about you." In the end, on a stone bench in a quiet part of Ketrickan's herb garden, August sat down and closed his eyes. "What message am I to skill to Shrewd?" I considered. This would be a game of riddles if I were to keep August unaware of my true problem. "Tell him Prince Ruarisk's health is excellent, and we may all hope to see him live to old age. Regal still wishes to give him the gift, but I do not think it appropriate." August opened his eyes.
"The skill is an important—"
"I know. Tell him." So August sat and took several breaths, and closed his eyes. After a few moments, he opened his eyes. "He says to listen to Regal."
"That's all?"
"He was busy, and very irritated. Now leave me alone. I fear you've made me a fool before my king." There were a dozen witty replies I could have made to that, but I let him walk away. I wondered if he had skilled to King Shrewd at all. I sat down on the stone bench and reflected that I had gained nothing at all and wasted much time. The temptation came, and I tried it. I closed my own eyes, breathed, focused, opened myself. "Shrewd, my king." Nothing, no reply. I doubt that I skilled at all. I rose and went back into the palace. Again, that day at noon, Ketrickan ascended the dais alone. Her words today were just as simple as she announced that she was binding herself to the people of the six duchies. From this moment hence, she was their sacrifice in all things, for any reason that they commanded it of her. And then she thanked her own people, blood of her blood, who had raised her and treated her well, and reminded them she did not change her allegiance out of any lack of affection for them, but only in the hopes that it would benefit both peoples. Again the silence held as she descended the steps. Tomorrow would be her day to pledge herself to Verity, as a woman to a man. From what I understood, Regal and August would stand beside her tomorrow in Verity's stead, and August would skill, so that Verity might see his bride, make her pledge to him. The day dragged on for me. Chongqui came and took me to visit the Blue Fountains. I did my best to be interested and pleasant. We returned to the palace for more minstrels and feasting, and that evening's display of arts by the mountain people. Jugglers and acrobats performed,
and dogs did tricks, and swordsmen displayed their prowess in stage bouts. Blue smoke was very much in evidence, and many were indulging, swinging their tiny censers before them as they milled about and talked to one another. I understood that for them it was like a carrot seed cake, a holiday indulgence, but I avoided the trailing smoke of the burn pots. I had to keep a clear head. Chade had supplied me with a potion to clear the head of wine fumes, but I had and knew of none for smoke, and I was unused to smoke. I found a clearer corner and stood apparently enraptured by a minstrel's song, but watching Regal over his shoulder. Regal sat at a table flanked by two brass burners. A very reserved August sat a slight ways from him. From time to time they spoke, August seriously, the prince dismissively. I was not close enough to hear the words, but I saw my name and skill from August's lips. I saw Ketrickin approach Regal and noted that she avoided being in the direct draught of the smoke. Regal spoke long to her, smiling and languid, and reached once to tap her hand and the silver rings she wore. He seemed to be one of those that the smoke made talkative and boastful. She seemed to teeter like a bird on a branch, now drawing closer to him and smiling, now drawing back and becoming more formal. Then Rurisk came to stand behind his sister. He spoke to Regal briefly and then took Ketrickin's arm and drew her away. Severins appeared and replenished Regal's burners. Regal gave a foolish smile of thanks and said something, indicating the whole hall with a wave of his hand. Severins laughed and left. Shortly afterward, Cobb and Raud arrived to speak to Regal. August rose and stalked indignantly off. Regal glared and sent Cobb to fetch him back. August came, but not graciously. Regal rebuked, and August glowered, then lowered his eyes and conceded. I wished desperately that I were close enough to hear what was said. Something, I felt, was definitely afoot. It might be nothing to do with me and my task, but somehow I doubted it. I went over my meager store of facts, feeling sure I was missing the significance of something, but I also wondered if I was not deceiving myself. Perhaps I was overreacting to everything. Perhaps the safest course was simply to do as Regal told me and let him accept the responsibility. Perhaps I should save time and cut my own throat. I could, of course, go directly to Rurisk, tell him that despite my best efforts, Regal still wanted him dead, and beg asylum of him. After all, who would not find attractive a trained assassin who had already turned on one master? I could tell Regal I was going to kill Rurisk, and then simply not do it. I thought carefully about that. I could tell Regal I was going to kill Rurisk, and then kill Regal instead. The smoke, I told myself, only the smoke made that sound so wise. I could go to Burridge and tell him I was really an assassin, and ask his advice about my situation. I could take the princess's mare and ride off into the mountains.
So, are you enjoying yourself?
Zhongkui asked, as she came up and took my arm. I realized I was staring at a man juggling knives and torches. I shall long remember this experience, I told her, and then suggested a stroll through the cool of the gardens. I knew the smoke was affecting me. Late that night, I reported to Regal's chamber. Raud admitted me this time, smiling pleasantly.
Good evening, he greeted me,
and I walked in as if into a wolverine's den. But the air within the chamber was blue with smoke, and this seemed the source of Raud's cheerfulness. Regal kept me waiting again, and though I tucked my chin to my chest and breathed shallowly, I knew the smoke was affecting me.
Control,
I reminded myself, and tried not to feel the giddiness. I shifted in my seat several times and finally resorted to openly covering my mouth and nose with a hand. It had small effect on screening the smoke. I looked up as the screen to the inner chamber slid aside, but it was only Severin's. He glanced at Raud, then came to sit beside me.
After a moment of his silence, I asked, "Will Regal see me now?" Severance shook his head.
"He is with a companion, but he has trusted me with all you need to know."
He opened his hand on the bench between us to show me a tiny white pouch.
"He has obtained this for you. He trusts you will approve. A little of this, mixed with wine, will cause death, but not soon. There will not even be symptoms of death for several weeks, and then it comes as a lethargy that gradually increases. The man does not suffer," he added, as if this were my primary concern.
I racked my brains. Is this Kexgum? I had heard of such a poison, but never seen it. If Regal had a source, Chade would want to know.
"I do not know its name, nor does it matter. Only this. Prince Regal says you will have a use for it tonight.
You will make an opportunity. What does he expect of me? That I will go to his chambers, knock, and enter with poisoned wine for him? Isn't that a bit obvious?"
"Done that way, of course it is. But surely your training has given you more finesse than that."
"My training tells me that things like this are not discussed with a valet. I must hear this from Regal, or I do not act." Severance sighed.
"Yet my master foresaw this.
This is his message. By the pin you carry and the crest on your breast, he commands this. Refuse it, and you refuse your king. You will be committing treason, and he will see you hang for it. But I...
take it and go. The longer you wait, the later it is, and the more contrived will seem your visit to his chambers."
Severance rose abruptly and left me.
Raud sat like a toad in the corner, eyeing me and smiling.
I would have to kill both of them before we returned to Buckkeep, if I were to preserve my usefulness as an assassin. I wondered if they knew that. I smiled back at Raud, tasting smoke in the back of my throat. I took my poison and left. Once at the base of Regal's staircase, I retreated to the wall where it was most shadowed and clambered as swiftly as I could up one of the supports of Regal's chamber. Clinging like a cat, I snugged myself up to the supports of the chamber floor and waited. And waited. Until between the smoke whirling in my head and my own weariness and the lingering effects of Ketrickin's herbs, I wondered if I were dreaming all of it. I wondered if my clumsy trap would yield me nothing. I considered, finally, that Regal had told me he had specifically requested Lady Time, but Shrewd had sent me instead. I recalled how Chade had puzzled over that, and finally I recalled his words to me. Had my king given me up to Regal, and if he had, what did I owe to any of them? Eventually, I saw Raud depart and, after what seemed a very long time, return with Cobb. I could hear little through the floor, but enough to know Regal's voice. My evening plans were being divulged to Cobb. When I was certain of it, I wriggled out of my hiding place, clambered down, and retreated to my own room. There I made certain of some specialized supplies. I reminded myself firmly that I was a king's man. I had told Verity so. I left my chamber and walked softly through the palace. In the great hall, the common folk slept on mats on the floor in concentric circles around the dais to have reserved the best viewing of their princess's pledging tomorrow. I walked among them, and they did not stir. So much trust, so ill placed. The chambers of the royals were at the extreme rear of the palace, farthest from the main entry. There were no guards. I walked past the door that led to the bedroom of the reclusive king, past Rurisk's door, and to Ketrickin's. Her door was decorated with hummingbirds and honeysuckle. I thought how much the fool would have liked it. I tapped lightly and waited. Slow moments passed. I tapped again. I heard the scruff of bare feet on wood, and the painted screen slid open. Ketrickin's hair had been freshly braided, but fine strands had already pulled free around her face. Her long white nightrobe accented her fairness so that she seemed pale as the fool.
"Do you need something?"
she asked sleepily. Only the answer to a question. The smoke still twined through my thoughts. I wanted to smile, to be witty and clever before her. Pale beauty, I thought. I pushed the impulse aside. She was waiting. "If I killed your brother tonight," I said carefully, "what would you do?" She did not even draw back from me.
"I would kill you, of course. At least I would demand it done, in justice. As I am pledged to your family now, I could not take your blood myself."
"But would you go on with the wedding? Would you still marry Verity?
Would you like to come in?"
"I haven't time." "Would you marry Verity?"
"I am pledged to the 6 duchies to be their queen. I am pledged to their people. Tomorrow I pledge to the king in waiting, not to a man named Verity. But even were it otherwise, ask yourself, which is the most binding? I am bound already. It is not just my work, but my father's and my brother's. I would not want to marry a man who had ordered my brother's death. But it is not the man I am pledged to. It is the 6 duchies. I am given there in the hopes of it benefiting my people. There I must go."
I nodded.
"Thank you, my lady. Forgive my disturbing your rest. Where do you go now?"
"To your brother." She remained standing in her door as I turned and walked to her brother's chamber. I tapped and waited. Rurisk must have been rested, for he opened the door much more quickly.
"May I come in?"
"Certainly."
Gracious, as I had expected. The edge of a giggle teased at my resolve. Chade would not be proud of you just now, I counseled myself, and refused to smile. I entered, and he closed the door behind me.
"Shall we have wine?"
I asked him.
"If you wish it,"
he said, puzzled but polite. I seated myself on a chair while he unstopped a carafe and poured for us. There was a censer on his table, too, still warm. I had not seen him indulge earlier. He probably had thought it more safe to wait until he was alone in his chamber. But you never can tell when an assassin will come calling with a pocketful of death. I pushed down a silly smile. He filled 2 glasses. I leaned forward and showed him my twist of paper. Painstakingly, I tipped it into his wine, picked up the glass, and swirled it to see it well dissolved. I handed it to him.
"I've come to poison you, you see. You die. Then Ketrickin kills me. Then she marries Verity."
I lifted my glass and sipped from it. Apple wine from Pharaoh, I guessed. Probably part of the wedding gifts.
"So what does Regal gain?"
Rurisk eyed his wine with distaste and set it aside. He took my glass from my hand. He drank from it. There was no shock in his voice as he said,
"He's rid of you. I gather he does not value your company. He has been very gracious to me, extending many gifts to me, as well as to my kingdom. But if I were dead, Ketrickin would be left sole heir to the Mountain Kingdom. That would benefit the 6 duchies, would it not? We cannot protect the land we already have.
And I think Regal would see it as benefiting Verity, not the kingdom." I heard a noise outside the door. "That will be Cobb, coming to